we've taken this kind of multi-omics toolkit and really worked on applying or generating phenotypes. So because one of the problems we have is we don't know what exactly is poor fertility. So everyone thinks there's poor fertility. Everyone sees the effect of poor fertility, but we don't know what it looks like in a male. And so our approach has been to go back to the drawing board, think like we don't know anything about it, and start with the basics and say, what's going on at the sperm level? What's going on in the semen? How are they changing? And what can we understand from there on?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Poultry Star is a unique feed ingredient that includes a prebiotic and probiotic, and it's designed specifically for poultry. Improve gut health with Poultry Star. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/poultrystar. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Zoetis Hatchery Health Team helps you raise field-ready birds with a strong immune foundation. Learn more at zoetis.com. Bin Sentry, the world's most trusted feed management platform.
Hi, welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Tim Johnson, and I am dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the poultry industry. So get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. We're delighted today to be joined by Dr. Giri Athri. Dr. Athri is a professor at Texas A&M University, and his lab uses a lot of what's near and dear to my heart, the multi-omics approaches, which involves things like genomics, transcriptomics, metabolomics, and then artificial intelligence to bring it all together. And he does this towards solving the complex issue of declining fertility in breeders. So I think this is a really timely topic, and we're delighted to have you, Dr. Athri. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe can you start by just telling us a little bit about how you got interested in breeder fertility and what you saw as the big problems that we face right now and how that came about?
Yeah, of course. I'm a geneticist by training, and I guess breeder fertility is something that we have worked on in the last 3-4 years, I would say. And before that, my lab was focusing on woody breast as an example of projects that we were looking at through and applying many of these omics approaches in that space. We have at Texas A&M a lot of patrons of our department, industry partners. And it was, you know, something that was a few years ago already was a concern for some of our biggest supporters, for example, Pilgrims. I remember a conversation with them and how concerned they were back then. And it just, conversations led to kind of trying to understand what is the problem, and that learning about their practices and just understanding that there are some gaps, because much of the foundational work in this space had been done many years ago, and perhaps even not entirely outdated, but definitely requiring a refresh. And it was a very interesting topic, because we'd already worked on some of these, as far as a geneticist's interests go. These pleiotrophic traits, which are things that kind of have differences or show differences in expression by developmental stage, and we had already been looking at this through our prior work, and this is fertility is another classic case where things change with age, as we know. So sexual maturity is something that happens later on, and the decline in sexual or reproductive performance is another age-related feature. And this was very interesting, both from a scientific perspective and obviously the high practical need. And so, yeah, we got into it, and we've been focusing a lot on the male fertility, because that, to my view, is like a major, an ignored area.
Every day you're up before the sun, caring for your animals, your land, and your livelihood. You don't cut corners, and neither do we. At Signify Animal Lighting, we use light as a tool, backed by science to support growth, comfort, and performance. We've spent decades studying how animals respond to light, how it guides their day, reduces stress, and supports the healthy growth you depend on. We turn that knowledge into lighting systems that help you create the right environment from sunrise to sundown. Better light, better animals. Better results with Signify.
Yeah, so I guess my naive question would be, has fertility been declining for years, and has it been the livability and things like that, is that decline accelerating, or is it static, or how long has this been going on?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think generally speaking, fertility is very interesting if you think about domesticated chickens, because the short answer to your question is, I think it's threatened to decline over many years, and they have caught it a couple of times and reversed the trend. And now in the last decade, it seems to be declining and hasn't been something easy to reverse. So that's the short answer. But again, fertility is, if you think about it, I think males and females have very different ways of expressing this trait. If you have ancestral strains of chicken, like, you know, jungle fowl, for example, they don't lay as many eggs in their lifetime. And so they have, you know, absolute fertility-wise, they're going to look pretty poor. But domesticated birds, now we have averaging over 300 birds, or, you know, in breeders, at least 200 plus birds a year. So if you look at it from that prism, huge improvement over the last century or so. But yeah, in the shorter term, yeah, it's declining. And the problem comes in because you have a huge scale to support right now, which wasn't always the case.
So there's been multiple blips in the radar where people have had to address this issue. Is there something about this time around that you think is different, or that are you learning anything about what might be going on here?
Yeah, that's the motivation for the work, for sure, to learn what exactly is going on. And it does appear to be a little bit, more serious from the way that we have seen it. So I think one of the key parts of this is in birds, in chickens, and in mammals too, there is a negative association with body weight in the males and the females too, right? So in broiler breeders, you have pretty elaborate feeding plans to maintain the body weight. And it's a known feature of how to keep fertility at a certain level, their reproductive performance, or how long they are able to keep up their egg-laying performance. And so every time in the past when they had to worry about this, they made some kind of a switch in the practice, perhaps. Hard to say exactly what on the genetic side. But definitely in the management practices, maybe they made some switches which helped recover some of that fertility. I think the last one was in around 2014 when there was a concern, and it lasted it was in the news because it was starting to affect consumer prices for poultry products, and it was kind of reversed fairly quickly. But then we now see that after that small correction, it's again been on a sliding, kind of trajectory.
So your approach, if I'm understanding, is to look at certain time frames in the life of the bird and use genetic approaches to try to understand what's being expressed or not expressed at different times, and how that might be concerning or useful. So how do you take... Mike, maybe just give the our viewers an example of how you would approach that from an experimental idea, and then maybe how does that eventually translate into change down the road?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so yes, the way you characterized it is mostly correct in that we are trying to understand over the span of a broiler breeder's lifespan, what's happening. So the longitudinal element has become like our kind of the foundation of what we're doing. So starting with, early in their reproductive maturity, and following different things as they are going all the way to the end of their reproductive performance. And so we've been focusing on many things based on, again, not reinventing anything, but looking at using established technologies to understand what are the possible mechanisms at play here. So are they genetic? Are they based on expression of certain genes at different times? Is it the semen microbiome, for example? And is it, even more fundamental? So starting with first principles, what are some of the sperm morphology and motility traits? Because there's a massive genetic element to those basic stuff, because, the process of making sperm is a very interesting many things can go wrong there, let's just say. So we've taken this kind of multi-omics toolkit and really worked on applying or generating phenotypes. So because one of the problems we have is we don't know what exactly is poor fertility. So everyone thinks there's poor fertility. Everyone sees the effect of poor fertility, but we don't know what it looks like in a male. And so our approach has been to go back to the drawing board, think like we don't know anything about it, and start with the basics and say, what's going on at the sperm level? What's going on in the semen? How are they changing? And what can we understand from there on?
That's great. And so if you can identify a phenotype that's associated with poor fertility, how do you take that then and make a difference? What's the next steps then?
Absolutely. Great question, right? So this is very exciting. So the thing is, so when I said phenotype, I think we had to ask what exactly is the phenotype that is valuable from an application perspective. And there's two aspects to fertility, right? So if you're thinking of a male, so there's one is how long can this male keep up these good traits, these semen traits, and obviously related to them, their body, their physical traits, where the outcomes are very good. So the hatchability, because that's the ultimate metric to know that it's actually working or it's getting worse. So while keeping that always in our view, we are trying to say, okay, there's many ways you can have good fertility. You can have absolute differences in fertility between males, variation, right? So you could have males which are, let's say, on average 80% fertility, meaning every insemination event from that male results in 80% chicks hatching. And versus compared to something that's 95%. So you have variation in individuals, which would tell us, okay, when there's population variation for a trait, you have genetic variation for the trait. So that's a potential way that you can have differences. The second is how long do they stay fertile? Because if you think from a practical perspective, there's two ways to make a difference if you're a male. You can produce eggs, or you can help produce eggs, which are all going to hatch out, right? So big number of eggs get hatched out. The second is you are able to do it for longer. And so there's a temporal element, so a time element to this also. So you may not be the greatest in terms of absolute percentage, but you can stick around for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, longer. And that's absolute money for a producer. So there's two angles that we've been looking at. And we used these two aspects to develop mathematical models to define the phenotype. And we call that the age of peak utility. And so this is something that we published earlier this year in Witherspoon et al. And this is a model that is applicable to chickens, but if you think about it, to anything that reproduces. And it uses these temporal kind of dynamics to say, hey, we can, using these mathematical models applied to the way that a male is performing over time, we're able to say which, at a flock level and at an individual level, which males are very good versus which males are not so good. And we can, again, take this type of a model and say, use that to develop biomarkers for early detection. So now we can say, we know what this high-performing male phenotype looks like. What are some early life biomarkers which can let us know in week 25 or week 28 when they're just started in the flock, this isn't going to be great. Or you can apply this to the flock level also, and you can say this flock is going to be good, but here's a projection for what you might expect. And when you may have to either switch out the entire males, which is what how they handle it, or you spike some males in to improve temporarily the fertility. So those are two application-oriented, details that emerge from this. And the other is APU, is what we call the age of peak utility, is something you could potentially use as a trait for selection. So if there's enough variation among flocks and among genetic lines of breeders, this is a feature which can be used for selection.
No, that's fantastic. I hadn't thought of it as a potential predictive tool, though, as well, with, you know, in an active flock. That's really interesting. So has there been anything that's come out of your work so far that has really surprised you or really excited you? I mean, can you think of something off the top of your head that for some of your favorite things that have happened? Or maybe most interesting?
I can tell you a couple which are from the published stuff, and maybe I can point to something from the upcoming unpublished stuff also, which I'll be presenting at PSA in about a month anyway. So I think a couple of the things that was surprising to me is to understand. So previous to this APU work, we did some other purely mathematical, statistical modeling work to kind of understand what is the impact of this loss of fertility. What are we talking about in terms of what it does to the supply chain, supply and demand? Can we continue to produce this many broilers if the breeder fertility is low? Because these are the things that people are going to tend to pay attention to, right? So if I had to say, well, I'm interested in broiler breeder fertility, microbiome, like, okay, so I don't know if I care about it so much, but if you are able to say, well, here's the potential impact for people, for the consumer, for the producer, I think it's going to catch a lot of interest. And we published this in 2025, and it's a paper in Poultry Science called How Concerned Should We Be About Broiler Breeder Fertility Declines? I think that's the title of the paper. And the short answer is, we should be very concerned. So yeah. No doubt about that. And the surprising thing there was, at the scale we are talking about, a 1% decline in fertility every year, and we're kind of roughly there at the moment, you're talking nearly 100 million chicks short every year.
That's a lot. That's a lot. Yeah, it's fascinating when you think about the economic impact, and a lot of people, I'm sure, don't realize the vastness of it, right?
Fall migration season may seem a long way off, but now is the time to prepare. Every poultry producer knows the risk avian influenza can bring. That's why American Air Filter, with advanced filtration technology designed to help protect barns from airborne disease, has teamed up with J&D Manufacturing's ventilation experts. Together, we help deliver cleaner air, stronger protection, and greater peace of mind for your operation. Don't wait until migration is underway. Start planning today with the team at J&D and American Air Filter. Learn more at jdaaf.com.
You mentioned some microbiome. Can you talk a little bit about that? And
yeah, that was going to be one of the things that I was going to tell you about. It's our forthcoming work by my student, Triumph Okuku. He's going to be defending soon. And yeah, it's another publication that we'll have out there hopefully soon. And we did a longitudinal semen microbiome study. And besides doing the characterization, we also kind of asked a lot of other questions in terms of like what's happening within a barn environment. How similar are they? That's like, you know, kind of an environmental aspect to it. And secondly, the endogenous aspect is what's happening to the function of the microbiome over this time. And there it's been very interesting too. So it's very interesting part is there is a huge amount of variation among individuals at the beginning of their reproductive lifespan. So even though there's a lot of genetic uniformity in the broiler breeders, their semen microbiomes are very diverse. They're very different from each other early on in life. And as they grow older, they become more like each other.
How long does that take, generally, approximately?
So this was data from, you know, a 6-month study. So over the span of 6 months, and we had samples, semen samples, like every week, we start seeing that they start, you know, converging in after about 2.5-3 months.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I know there's been a lot of discussion, but I haven't seen a lot of hard science on the potential that I wouldn't call them necessarily pathogens, but maybe opportunistic type pathogens might be playing a role in some of this, things like Enterococcus and other bacteria like that. Have you seen signals of that too, potentially? Or
we do. I think I would say that the taxa are informative, but I don't believe they are going to turn. I mean, this is my feeling at the moment. Is the taxa are not going to become diagnostic for declines. I think the composition of the taxa and therefore the function is probably more diagnostic. That's what we are seeing. And so there's like some sort of predicted functional and chemical changes in the semen over this time, and which also starts to converge on the time when things start to go wrong for the males. And we've obviously tried to see if there's, you know, indicator taxa that will tell you, hey, if you find this, you're in trouble. I don't think that's a case that can be made. There's going to be, you know, I mean, without knowing or without replicating this work across barns, across farms, I would be hesitant to say that we can pinpoint like a few taxa which are going to drive something like that. But I think the function, the shifts in the function are a lot more informative.
So the shift in the function would represent it, you know, the microbiota responding to what's available to them then basically as the semen changes or the environment changes, you think?
Absolutely. And yeah, if I had to point out to one thing which isn't really that surprising is the oxidative environment of the semen is changing. And so you see that, okay, well, now you have, you know, a shift towards mostly kind of anaerobic microbiome. Yeah. And also suggesting some changes in the pH of the semen itself, which can be very interesting in its own right. So you know, you have like a potentially a more of a chemical marker of what's going on, which is a far more simpler thing than saying I need to run a qPCR to see if this taxa is there. So it becomes, you know, hopefully it's something we can replicate, but that's what it's tending towards at the moment.
No, that's really interesting. Kind of a way to have a sentinel look at what's happening, right? And I know a lot of your work you've talked about the use of artificial intelligence, and I'm always curious about you're gathering these massive data sets, right, that are multiple types of data. How does AI come into play to help your work? How does that work?
Yeah, I think I would say multiple levels, right? So I think I'm kind of become a gadfly, a thorn in the side of my students on this point, because I was trained as a quantitative geneticist. I did a lot of coding, you know, in my high school days. So it hasn't been so much of a shift for me to kind of, or I've always done a lot of coding as someone who does bioinformatics. So it's been less of a difficult thing for me to wrap my head around compared to students who don't come with this background, who are coming mostly from an agriculture, a husbandry, animal care background. And they don't have the training. That's why we are here. You know, we train them. And it's my job to get them prepared for this world also. And so I think, yeah, so to your question, it's become a part of our discussions in many phases. One is everyone, all the our stakeholders want students to be AI, not just AI literate, but AI competent. And so this is an interesting bar to meet. And what it means is they're not looking for someone who can look for answers in ChatGPT or Claude or something like that, right? So it's way more than that. So there's that to make them realize, and what does that work actually look like? So we've been closely following the developments in this field. And for many months now, we've kind of talked about, well, what does AI represent to you in terms of what is it that's going to be unique about your contribution? Because if you're shaping yourself as something that could be done by an AI agent in the future, you're going to have a problem. So there's that. So what is the unique human aspects that you can bring while becoming proficient in AI is the thing that we spend a lot of time about, and that's decision making, right? Human judgment and decision making is something it's already, I would say, difficult without the AI world, because it pops up like a million options and you are still having to pick a good one from there. So it only makes it more difficult, I would say, if you take a long time or you to make up your mind or you're indecisive about something, right? So there's that. So you need a lot more clarity. So I talked to them about that. And then in terms of the actual generation of hypotheses, there's AI tools already, even, you know, forget Google's or Gemini co-scientists, which is apparently going to come out soon, but there's already tools which will generate like a lot of statistical hypotheses. So this is something we've been doing in my lab for many months now. Take an old data set and run a hackathon in my lab meetings where we're sitting around and say, hey, let's take this data set and go wild with hypotheses that we couldn't test before in the short amount of time because it was limited by time for someone to graduate or whatever, right? And in the process, walk them through the idea of how to develop your thinking about these tools. What are we going to do? How are you going to use it to generate code for you? How to verify that work for you, how to visualize the data, and of course, how to test multiple hypotheses. So this is, I guess, at a training level, this has been a big way that we are using it. And then in the work, we use all these multimodal data sets, right? So we have everything from images to spectra to spreadsheets, numerical data sets. And we use many neural networks and deep learning, deep neural networks, AI approaches in this space to actually understand our data and to test hypotheses there. So we couldn't do the second part if they weren't thinking about that on the practice pitch, so to speak, right? So
it's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. At Signify Animal Lighting, we use light as a tool, backed by science to support growth, comfort, and performance. Better light, better animals. Better results with Signify. Barnwell Bio generates actionable health insights from your barn's microbiome. Visit barnwellbio.com. At Zoetis, we bring you more than the tools for hatchery success. We bring you a team, expert support, biodevice precision, and vaccine protection, helping you raise field-ready birds with a strong immune foundation. The Zoetis Hatchery Health Team. Trusted people, science-backed processes, reliable protection. Learn more at zoetis.com.
No, it's fascinating to me. I mean, just the changing landscape of how we train the next generation of scientists, right? And we're speeding up the things that they can do, but it still requires that critical thinking aspect of it, right? So it's moving fast, right? So if somebody wants to learn more about breeder fertility, do you have a resource that you would guide them to, maybe if they're new to the topic or just want to learn a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a few foundational papers that we also found very interesting. I mean, I could speak mostly about male fertility, which has been our focus. So maybe my answers will be a little tilted towards that at the moment. There's some amazing foundational works from the 80s and 90s and other landmark papers. So, for example, I can think of, more recent, if I would have to say, in the previous decade, 2013 or 14, there's a Fragoso, if I'm thinking correctly, yeah, it's a Fragoso et al. Paper, which is a very instructional paper. If you go back, there's some, and I cannot recollect the authors, but maybe if you have some footnotes, I can submit those to them for your podcast. But there are some really solid papers on the understanding the basics of fertility, like what's happening, ideas on polyspermy, which is a condition in birds, which is so unique. And you need a threshold of sperm to penetrate before fertilization actually occurs. And there's these absolutely, fascinating foundational papers that I think anyone who's interested should read. And the way I think about it is to step outside of our discipline a little bit. So I read papers, about other avian models. So there's some excellent male fertility papers, male, sperm or semen trait papers in from ostriches and rheas, though that I can also recommend. And then, of course, our papers, which you can find on on our website. If you visit my lab's website, you can find them there as well.
Fantastic. That's great advice. And you had some really good insights about students and things they need to think about. But if we just say more generally with a poultry science student that's up and coming, are there certain attributes or things that they can do that you think will help them be successful in their careers?
Certainly. I think I think one thing I appreciate about poultry science students coming through our department, I mean, Texas A&M, we have the biggest undergrad population in the country. And they're amazingly smart and driven people who are very passionate about poultry. They come up through, you know, 4-H and FFA pathways. And they are very well prepared in many ways. I mean, you know, I'm talking about, you know, a majority of them who come up like this, right? And they, yeah, they've done judging. So they know a lot about chicken, either from their own experience in their families or through these high school programs. And I think, especially if I remember correctly, 4-H is doing like, they're expanding their programming because now I see there's a STEM aspect to 4-H programming, also coding and whatnot. So yeah, what the reason I'm talking about it, I think they're very entrepreneurial already. They want to do stuff. They're very passionate about the field, and honestly, that's the biggest hurdle to be successful in life. And if you have that, I think you are halfway there. And then there's many other things to be learned, and that's a lifelong process. And if I had to give them only one advice, then I wouldn't want to pick on some technical stuff and say, okay, do this or do that. I think it's to just cultivate a mentality for growing, to continue to grow, to be hungry to learn and to improve themselves and to see the bigger purpose in what we do in agriculture, that we are here to, you know, alleviate hunger in this world, help, you know, provide economical or affordable food for billions, right? So yeah, keep those in mind, and I'm sure that's kind of part of what inspired them in the first place. But yeah, to continue growing and challenging themselves, and AI is one of them, right? So it's the newest thing on the landscape. So I wouldn't say, oh yeah, you need to go and take classes. No, I don't think that's quite it, because in 10 years it might be something else, and you don't want to be pigeonholed and don't know what to do. So yeah, just keep that mentality to grow.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. Well, thank you, Dr. Rathri, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And this concludes another episode of the Poultry Podcast produced by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and stay updated for future episodes. And if you liked today's podcast, please leave a review. Your feedback is invaluable. And until next time, thanks again. This is Tim Johnson.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.